All right, here's what you need to know about on this day. If Jeffrey Epstein's death is somehow related to the attack in Iran, then you definitely need to know about these two new details regarding this. One is how he died. Some really interesting new information on that. And the other is about President Trump, and it's kind of ugly. Gas prices are going up in places like the United States and India, and now we're seeing long lines. Seeing them, and I'm going to show them to you. Also, two questions. Why are Iran's missiles hitting their targets so effectively? And why are the U.S.'s defense systems doing the opposite? Scott Ritter is going to be here to talk to me and try and explain this to us, because he's got a beat on it. This is The Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thank you so much for being with us. And yeah, there is a bit of a blockbuster that we want to start with today. And this is a story that's being reported by none other than Julie Brown. Julie Brown, I know. She works for the Miami Herald, a good newspaper. Like, here's what you need to know about Julie Brown. Julie Brown was the person who broke the Epstein story. You would never have heard of Jeffrey Epstein. I would never have heard of Jeffrey Epstein. No one would have heard of Jeffrey Epstein had it not been for Julie Brown. One reporter making phone calls, asking good questions at the Miami Herald, my hometown newspaper. So if she's reporting something, that usually means it's credible. This time, her story seems to support the case that Epstein was actually killed by the guards that were assigned to watch him. Here's the headline. Take a look at this. See this? Prison guards discussed a cover-up of Epstein's death, inmate tells FBI. Miami Herald. So apparently there was an inmate that was in the cell, right, next to where Epstein was, and he woke up like at 6:30 in the morning, and all of a sudden there was a lot of commotion and noise, he says. And then he heard, breathe, breathe. So he recalled officers that were shouting about that time. And then he heard an officer say, dudes, you just killed that dude. That's what's being reported. A female guard in there, I guess with Epstein, suddenly was heard saying, if he's dead, we have to cover this up. And we need to have an alibi. Our officers, referring to the other guards, I guess, that were there with her. Now, according to hidden FBI report up to now, which has now been released, the inmate says this whole thing was overheard by the entire wing. In other words, all the prisoners who were on the wing then later on were talking about this and were saying to each other, Miss Noel killed Jeffrey. Miss Noel killed Jeffrey. Well, who's Miss Noel? Well, they've identified this female guard as Tova Noel, the woman guard who was watching Epstein at the time. And apparently the phone records now show what she was Googling before Epstein died, before they even went into his cell, right? 40 minutes before Epstein died, she was Googling about Epstein's condition. Why would she do that? They also found out that she had deposited $5,000 into her bank account about 5-6 days after Epstein died as well. This is a story that's making headlines today in the United States, and this one as well, having to do with Mr. Trump. Look at this. The FBI apparently did 4 interviews with the woman who has described how Mr. Trump sexually abused her when she was 13 years old. Now, a lot of people can make allegations. A lot of people can say a lot of things, right? So what makes this important? Well, as you probably know, in the interviews, this is all out there now, she alleges what Mr. Trump did to her. And it's kind of specific and kind of gross, you know, for what it's worth. Especially gross for those of us who have daughters or wives or just respect people, I guess. But what makes this story today more salient, more noteworthy, more credible? It's the fact that they interviewed her 4 times. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. I've worked with police officers. I've been a police officer, a cop beat reporter for years. That's how I started in this business. When police officers get a call and somebody says they have something important to tell them, they may go talk to them one time and then they usually go, crazy, or nah, it doesn't work, whatever, right? Sometimes they'll talk to her a second time, maybe take down a statement. But the fact that the FBI, we now learn, went and talked to this woman, not once, not twice, not three times, but four different times to take different statements from her. That's what makes this story on this day so important. Speaking of stories in America, watch this. This is crazy. Apparently, this video reveals what, according to police, are two guys. There they are right there. That's the two of them you just saw right there. They tried to place what appears to be a bomb. Not appears to be. We now know it's been confirmed. It's an explosive device. There it is right there in front of the home of the mayor of New York, one of the most important politicians in all of the United States, Zora Mandami. The scene is crazy when you look at this. The men are running in different direction. The guy gives the bomb or the explosive device to one guy, then he gives it to the other guy, then he throws it in front of the men. It looks kind of like it's all discombobulated, right? Now, these men were part of a protest that were taking place in front of the mayor's house. It's called Gracie Mansion. There were two protests, really. One was against Muslims, because the mayor is kind of pro-Muslim. The other one was by other people who were protesting the protest. These men are identified as Emir Balat and Ibrahim Kayumi. They were part of the second protest. Now, the motive is still unknown. Here's what else we need to know, because now we start moving into the conversation about the war in Iran. The war in Iran is having an effect on the people of the United States, and it's not the effect that the president of the United States wanted. He was thinking people were going to be celebrating this. Yay, Mr. President, you're so tough. You're going to take care of those big, bad Iranians. No. People in America are angry. And you know what? One of the things that they're angry about, besides the war, which they tend to by far be against? Look at this message that was put out by a very respected U.S. congressman, one of the only respected U.S. congressmen. His name is Thomas Massie. And he writes, the price of gas has gone up 47 cents. And the price of diesel has gone up 83 cents in just 10 days due to the war. And waging this war is costing American taxpayers about $1 billion a day. So what's the effect on Americans? Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to take you now to the gas station where I fill up my car whenever it starts to look like it's empty. This is about a couple of blocks from our house. This is not in Miami. It's in Fort Lauderdale, where my wife and my kids are. Take a look at this report from there.
Typically, when you come to these big wholesale stores like Costco here in Davie, there's going to be always a bit of traffic, folks trying to get in. But look at this live picture right now. You can see plenty of cars here. We talked to a worker here. She says she hasn't seen it like this in a long time. Here in Davie from Chopper 6, you can see the long lines. The traffic in and out of this Costco is nonstop.
And you know, I looked around this morning because I wanted to see, well, where else is this going on? It's not everywhere, but there's enough that people are talking about it. I know when I talk to my friends in the United States, that's what they're saying. My wife told me the other day, I got to get up early to get gas. I was like, wow, this again. But it's not just the United States. I want to show you some video now that we got from India. Look at this. This is India. People lining up to get their LNG. Yeah, so they get their, you know, liquefied natural gas, their gas that they put in there, that they use to cook, to refill all of their cooking containers, which is quite popular in India. And everybody has to line up now, but they think there isn't going to be enough. So there's a mad dash, and people are waiting in these lines. Now, to be fair, some of this isn't because there's a shortage. It's because people are simply freaked out about this. And they're worried that there will be a shortage. So that's what's going on in the United States. That's what's going on in India and who knows in how many other different places. So then we got to ask ourselves, you know, why is this happening, right? Why is this happening right now? Well, it's because Israel and the United States may have underestimated the size of the hornet's nest that it disrupted. You see, all Muslims across the Middle East are somewhat furious about this, especially the Shias, right? And then there's this. Even corporate media now, because I've seen the reports myself, are starting to admit how surprisingly effective Iran's missiles have been. In fact, I wanted to show you this. We could have gone on forever with this, but I just want to give you a sampling. Our editors put together like a montage of all the direct hits on all the different facilities that we've just seen in the last couple of days. Here, take a look at this. By the way, Israel does not want you to know this, but we've seen the pictures that are getting out because they're pretty much trying to block out any video coming out of places like Tel Aviv. But there are, I've seen devastation in Tel Aviv. I've seen video after video and picture after picture of scenes in Tel Aviv that look like they have been very seriously damaged. Exactly what the count is, we don't know at this point, and we're not going to dare guess. So why are all these missiles getting through? Well, Iran's drone technology is a big part of this. They didn't use this in the past, but they're hitting it now. The Wall Street Journal, as you can see there, is reporting that they're using satellites and knocking out the satellite systems that are used by the United States. See those satellite systems that you see in that article right there? They basically tell the interceptors where the missiles are. But if you knock out the satellites, the interceptors don't know what to do. That's why you've seen all these pictures of missiles coming in, and you see the interceptors trying to hit the missile, and they go like this and like this. You know, and those of us who don't know anything about this kind of thing are going, wait a minute, I don't think that's the way that's supposed to work, right? But that's what we're seeing. And I think that's the reason for it. So they've got these advanced satellite systems that they got from China. They've got drone know-how and technology from Russia, intelligence from both to tell them where the U.S. and the Israeli stuff is so they know where to hit. In fact, listen to Scott Ritter, right? He's going to be joining us a little bit later in the show, but he's as smart as anybody when it comes to this kind of stuff. Look how he explains this one latest example of how intel was used against the Israelis in this case. Take a listen to it.
It appears that the Iranians struck a building, and that building contained Israeli officers who were carrying out a conference about this war. The location of that building had been selected by the Israelis in the morning, meaning that by striking this building and killing the people inside, Iran not only proved that they had the capability to penetrate Israeli air defense at any time, this building was selected because it was supposed to be ringed by sufficient air defense systems, but Iran also showed that they have the ability to collect intelligence information, highly accurate intelligence information about the most sensitive topics in Israel, and respond in a timely fashion, killing the Israelis involved. This, more than anything, scares the Israelis because they now know they are all literally dead men walking.
So the Iranians, he said, have intel they've never had before, and they're able to evade the defense systems. Those are the two most important things in a situation like this. But, you know, like an ostrich that wants to hide its head in the ground to avoid reality, I'm hearing these U.S. neocons telling themselves and probably whispering to Mr. Trump, boss, don't worry about all that. That's not true. Don't listen to Scott Ritter. Don't listen to Doug McGregor. Don't listen to any of these people. Don't listen. No. Just go on CNN and tell them what we know is true. This is total devastation. None of Iran's missiles are getting through. And if one gets through from time to time, it's just very few, very few. Yeah, that's what they're saying. I watch them. In fact, I was just invited to a show over the weekend. I don't know if you guys saw this. I've been invited lately to be a guest on a lot of shows, and I was invited on TRT, which is a fabulous network, right? It's a television network from Turkey. Watch what the other guests, both our U.S. ambassadors, said while I was on the air talking with them. And I had just said we should be concerned about the effectiveness of Iran's missiles. And he comes back with this.
What seems to be happening in this case and across the board, with very few Iranian missiles hitting the mark, is that there has been a devolution of command authority within the Iranian military. This has been reported upon rather extensively. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the regime seems to be in utter disarray. Mm-hmm.
Did you say very few Iranian missiles are hitting their mark? Did I just hear you say that?
I like when they say, well, this has been reported about quite extensively. What the hell does that even mean? This guy's actually sitting there with a straight face saying, oh, yeah, the United States is destroying all of Iran, and, you know, very few of their missiles are even getting through. Then what are we looking at? This is why, for good measure, pardon me, I'm not usually a mean guy, but I decided to be mean here. And I kind of gave him a little parting shot of truth at the end of the interview. Here, watch what I said to him.
And it's great to be able to once again be on with two neocon guests who get their news from NBC and CNN and share the perspective that everything everybody in the world does is bad except the United States, who's glorious, wonderful, and everything they do is great.
I'm sorry. I mean, some things just have to be said. By the way, they were furious. Furious! Never be invited back to talk to this guy. Never have ever. They're so mad at me. But you know what? Sometimes you just have to say things as they are, right? I appreciate the fact that TRT had me on to give, if nothing else, a little bit of a different perspective. And by the way, I'm thinking here now, of all the countries that should be vigilant, it's Turkey, speaking of TRT, because it's next on Israel's sights of countries that Israel wants the United States to attack. Because Israel doesn't attack. They just call Washington and say, hey, hit these guys, hit Iraq, hit Syria, hit Libya, hit Iran. The next one is hit Turkey. That's not me. It's not Rick Sanchez saying that, by the way. So don't take my word for this. Listen to Israel's former prime minister.
Turkish threat is emerging. I want to be very clear. Turkey and Qatar have gained influence in Syria, are seeking influence elsewhere and everywhere throughout the region. And from here, I warn, Turkey is the new Iran.
And now this, just before going on the air, we learned that, believe it or not, we hadn't even planned for this, because I had prepared some of this material a couple hours ago, and now, just before going on the air, we hear that the United States is evacuating some staff at their embassy in Istanbul. Let's do this. We've got a correspondent I think we can go to. If he's ready to go, Yasim Ekin is joining us now, RT correspondent, reporting from Istanbul. What are you hearing? Is that true, what I just reported or said we think is happening? Am I right?
You are right, Rick, and it's not necessarily coincidence. And I don't want to speculate, because when the embassy in Ankara issued the order to push all non-essential personnel and families outside of the consulate in Adana, which is in the southeast of the country, right by the border with Syria, naturally, everyone had thoughts in their head. But one thing that is interesting is an hour after that order was issued, naturally, we heard from the Ministry of National Defense. We heard from the Director of Communications, and they stated that they intercepted another projectile. So things do seem to be tense on the border, but depending on who you ask, they might tell a different story.
Projectile from whom? I mean, are these who's shooting? If someone's shooting at Turkey, we need to know who's shooting at Turkey, right?
Naturally. Now, this is the second such case. The first time it happened, there was a little bit of ambiguity. But the second time around, which is about an hour or two before we went live, the Ministry of National Defense issued a statement. They said that the projectile, the ballistic missile, was launched from Iran. So what this tells us is that Ankara is in a position where it is monitoring everything, and it was able to monitor that projectile, that missile, from Iran, and they intercepted it. Naturally, NATO assets within the East Mediterranean intercepted that projectile before it made its way into Turkish airspace. But, I mean, forgive me here, but what comes next is definitely the next question. Is Turkey being dragged into this conflict?
Exactly. And
it depends on who you ask. It depends on who you ask, right? The Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan on Saturday held an informal meeting with the Organization of Turkic States, met with the foreign ministers of several countries all across the board. The topic was Iran. And in that press conference, he said one thing that was quite clear as day. He said, look, if it's a one-off thing, we're willing to look past it. But if it happens again, then we're going to treat this as a more serious matter and we are going to retaliate. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that Turkey is going to engage and be provoked and dragged into the war. Ankara has been very clear that Turkey is not going to enter this war. Turkey is not going to fight against Iran. And most importantly, Turkey is not going to be used as a tool.
Well, here's what we need to understand. Let's set the table. Iran has said, the foreign minister told me this himself, Aracha, if they hit us, we will hit them from where they hit us. And if they have bases in this part of the world, we are going to hit those bases. So, as we know, Iran has hit, and quite effectively, Oman and UAE and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait. If the United States has military installations in Turkey and is in any way using those bases to attack Iran, then Iran would say that is fair game. And they would probably counter with, and I'm not putting words in their mouth, but you can help me here, we're not attacking you, Turkey. We're attacking the installations that the United States has in your country. Is that what we're really talking about?
In theory, yes. But as to how this plays out is, I think, a bigger concern. In theory, yes, of course. So Iran could definitely say that you have the United States operating. And this is, I think, an important caveat that we need to differentiate and highlight. The United States does not possess a base of its own within Turkish borders. It is a Turkish base that is a joint operation with NATO. And the United States, along with a number of other nations, from France to Spain, there are a number of different military personnel that are currently being kept in that space. But, of course, this is a war of words, right? So, like you said, Iran could very well say, well, you know, the United States, the aggressor, is definitely using this base to carry out its operations. Huh. And if they do, that's another hypothetical. But if that happens, then, again, the bigger question is, well, what comes next?
Yeah.
Now, I think the issue with Iran was, and correct me if I'm wrong here, the issue with Iran was the United States, to a large degree, did underestimate them.
Yeah.
And the reason why, we always talk about military power, right? We say the United States has the technological advancements, they have the resources, which is the case. And in contrast, Iran doesn't have that. But then it begs the question, well, how is Iran in a position to win, hypothetically speaking? And as time goes on, that reality becomes much more consistent. And I think the same could be said about Turkey. So Iran could hypothetically attack the Turkish bases that host the NATO and U.S. Troops. But I think it's a lot easier said than done. And I don't necessarily think Iran is in a position where it wants to do that, right?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Why would you want to conflagrate things? Why? I mean, if you got three people you're hitting and some of them are hitting back, why would you want to add to your enemies list in a situation like this? That's why the caveats and the nuance here is so important. So I'll leave you with this question, I guess, because our viewers are probably wondering. Do you believe Turkey would feel like, hey, they're hitting us, we are going to have to soon come up with a way to hit back? Or are they looking at this as more complex and they can probably figure it out on the phone by having the foreign ministers or maybe even at a higher level talk to each other?
I think you put it clearly, and it's possible it could be one of two ways, if not both, actually. The diplomacy definitely will be a channel that will be available, no matter the conflict. But I also think that if push comes to shove, Turkey is in a position with, and the Turkish foreign minister, the president, have said time and time again, essentially, don't test our resolve.
Yeah.
Turkey is not a pushover. And Turkey and Iran, they share a lot, if you think about it. You know, Iran has faced sanctions over the years. It's had adverse effects on its economy and its capability to build its military infrastructure. Turkey, to a similar degree, has that as well. But there is a level of self-sufficiency that the Turkish state has been successful in producing its own capabilities and its reliance on its own indigenous infrastructure.
Yeah.
But There's that aspect, and you've been around the region, Rick. You probably understand this better than most. The people in the region, in the broader Middle East and parts of Asia, they have an interesting resolve, especially when they feel like they are being attacked.
Yes.
So, very briefly, I want to talk to you about what the Turkish response has been. Yes, I said, you know, the Turkish foreign minister made statements, the president did, the defense minister, but the people. And going through social media this past week, a lot of Turkish accounts have actually been sharing videos on how to use an F-16, how to essentially take off, lock on your missiles and land, tanks, helicopters. The list goes on. So to a degree, I feel like the Turkish people are kind of in a state where, well, if this fight's going to come to us, we're not going to be provoked. We're not going to be tricked. But if push comes to shove, bring it on is essentially, I think, the mindset for a lot of Turkish people.
Listen, Yasin, what you're talking about is in many ways similar to the conversations I've had with officials in Pakistan and Qatar and in other places. That it's a mindset, it's a sense of will, and there is a fear that is permeating the region right now. And that's why these things can spiral, which is the biggest fear of all. Good reporting, man. You're really good at explaining things. You made it so clear to me and to our audience. We really thank you for that.
It's my pleasure.
Yasin Makin, reporting from Istanbul about the situation in Ankara. My favorite part of the show is coming up. I'm going to have an opportunity to talk to Scott Ritter. Scott, as you know, is a former U.S. weapons inspector. He is a Marine. He's also just a tough guy who's a really good man who happens to believe in truth. And, you know, we're going to be hopefully talking about some of these truths when we come back right here. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect. Hey, by the way, we just hit 100,000 followers on YouTube. And guess what? Within the last couple of days, we hit 110. So we're growing so fast. Thank you so much for letting us into our homes, into your homes. We'll be right back with Scott. Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for being here. Let's talk to Scott Ritter. As you probably know, he's a former U.S. weapons inspector. He was the guy who had the intestinal fortitude to say before the Iraq War, this is bullcrap and they have no weapons of mass destruction. Not enough people listened to him, but he was a lone, brave voice at the time. He continues to be that lone, brave voice, talking this time about the situation in Iran. Scott, always great to see you, my dear friend.
Thank you very much for having me. Good to see you.
Let's start with the process. We're going to get into you trying to explain to me what the hell is going on with these interceptors that don't seem to be working, which we were told were so fantastic and incredible. But before we get to that, I'd just like to get your sense as an American about what our government is doing in terms of how they explain what the decision was to go to war. They're changing explanations about not just that, but what's actually happening on the ground. And the relationship evolving with Israel throughout this. So let's just start there. What do you make so far of the handling of the war by the Trump administration?
Well, it's been the most grotesque mismanagement imaginable. First of all, let's start off with the notion that the United States is a constitutional republic founded on the basis of the rule of law. That is an absolute, both in terms of domestic application and through international law. We have always claimed that this was our core value. We haven't always operated with that, but at least there was the pretense that we were a nation that adhered or sought to adhere to the rule of law. This war is an illegal war of aggression with no foundation in any legal authority, domestic or international. This is the ultimate war crime that's being perpetrated. And the fact that the American people remain ignorant of this is as much on the government as it is on them. We have long ago stopped being effective citizens here in this country. We have long ago stopped holding our government accountable for what they do in our name. We are a nation of compliant sheep, and we have a psychopath that is our shepherd leading us down this path. So this is an illegal war of aggression right off the start. How do you explain an illegal war of aggression? Well, you lie. And this administration has lied across the board. We've lied about why we're fighting this. The fact is the administration can't articulate a cognizable reason why we're engaged in this conflict. We were told it's about nuclear threat, but we know that Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, who is ultimately responsible for the singular assessment from the U.S. intelligence community, that there is no nuclear threat from Iran, that Iran is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. But the president has chosen to embrace an alternative set of facts. And those alternative set of facts come from Israel. And so now we have the real reason. We are going to war for Israel on a timetable designed by Israel to achieve objectives that benefit Israel, but not the United States. And in the process, we have abandoned all those whom we claim to be our regional allies, all of the Gulf Arab states who've been buying billions of dollars of American military equipment under the pretense that the United States would be there for them in their time of crisis, are now looking around abandoned by the United States because we only defend one nation, and that is the nation of Israel, and we're not even doing a good job at that. The president has changed his war plan 5 times in 10 days. That tells you how utterly confused they are. They went to war based upon artificial, unachievable objectives. The notion of regime change by assassinating Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Twelver faction of the Shia faith in Iran, that you're going to kill this man and the faithful will collapse, is absurd. The exact opposite took place by murdering Ali Khamenei, and it was an act of murder. What we did is ensure that the Iranian people rally around this government in a way that we will never be able to separate the two. There will never be regime change in Iran. 90 million people will all die before they give in to the United States. That is the fact. And then we were told that there was, that there wouldn't be a big price to pay because this war was going to be over quickly, that we have overwhelming military power that is being brought together in a comprehensive fashion. Pete Hegseth has said, we are the most lethal fighting force on the face of the earth. We kill, 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 and the Iranians don't stand a chance. And yet Pete Hegseth has had to change his war plan 5 times in 10 days because we're not achieving military objectives. In fact, just the opposite. The enemy is defeating us across the board. The United States is not only losing this war, Rick, we have lost this war. We will not achieve any of the objectives we have set out to achieve. At the end of the day, we will run out of the ability to defend ourselves long before the Iranians run out of the ability to attack us.
Let me move to that question about what's going on, because you stated it so well, but we're looking at some of the video now, and if we can put those up once again, I keep seeing, Scott, and I don't understand this, but you do, why is it that our missile defense system, which was supposed to be THAAD and others, are supposed to be so incredibly effective that very few missiles, I heard Iron Dome, all these great cool words, are supposed to be so effective that anytime somebody tries to shoot a missile into those systems, it will be intercepted and destroyed in the air. But every time I look at these videos, I'm seeing just the opposite of this. Not in all cases, obviously, but in way, way too many, and you can see the damage on the ground. What's happening? Why are the interceptors not destroying the missiles aimed for their targets in all of these places?
Well, first of all, Rick, we're talking about a ballistic missile defense architecture that wasn't designed to do what it's doing. There are parts of this. We have Iron Dome, which is designed to shoot down Katyusha rockets. We have the Arrow 3 developed by Israel for an Israeli application, David Sling, an improvement on Arrow 3. Then you have the United States weaving in Patriot 3. Then we weave in THAAD. Then we weave in the Aegis system on a ship. All of these were designed separately. They were never designed to work together. Mm. That wasn't the intent, but that's what we've done to create this ballistic missile defense architecture over Israel and the Middle East, is that we've woven in these disparate parts. So now they have to communicate with one another. Now you have to get them to talk to one another, and you have to create interfaces so that they can start to differentiate targets, prioritize targets, pick which systems can attack the targets when. Let's just start right off the bat that none of these systems were designed to intercept missiles coming in at the speeds that the Iranian missiles are coming in. Wow. So all of the systems are inadequate from the start. Now we try to improve on that adequacy or inadequacy by queuing. So we have radars out there that are detecting launch, trying to provide advanced notification so that the radar systems can narrow the focus of their search beam and try and anticipate, launch, and get an intercept. And so what the, so we have this architecture now that is artificially constructed. It's not designed to do what it's going to be asked to do. And then what the Iranians have done is said, okay, we're going to destroy your eyes. We're going to destroy the radars up front that are doing the initial cueing. And then we're going to destroy your ability to communicate. We're going to destroy the satellite communication relays. And so what happens is we have all these systems that in order to function to one another need to communicate with one another. And they need to have cueing data that is shared and resources allocated, et cetera. The Iranians have made us blind and deaf. And now when the missiles come in, the systems are simply inadequate to the task. And so we end up firing more interceptors than designed, running through our munitions, while the Iranians are simply firing their old stuff. So anything we intercept is a throwaway missile. The Iranians are doing it simply to burn through interceptor stocks. But when the Iranians fire their more advanced systems, the architecture simply is cannot do the job. Now, I just want to jump over to Turkey for a second.
Sure.
And understand and add to the discussion
on
Turkey.
But thank you for that explanation. I mean, I've never heard it put that way, that there are so many systems trying to work together, and they're just not designed to do that, which is part of what's the confusion is. But yes, let's talk about Turkey. You heard the were you able to hear the report I had with my correspondent?
I did. Turkey is related to the problem we just talked about. You see, the United States ballistic missile defense architecture for the Middle East is blind right now. It can't see. In Turkey, there are two facilities. Mm-hmm. One is an old radar used to track satellites near Perinçalık. The United States turned that over to Turkey. This is older technology, but it has an application. We used it in Desert Storm to track Iraqi missiles coming into Israel. It gives you initial launch data and indication of flight and where it could land. It allows you to predict where missiles are going to land. Mm. The Turks own this facility now. To the extent that this facility is still functioning and integrated with NATO, I don't know. But what I do know is near this facility, Kirtchik, is the United States has installed a giant X-band radar that's linked to the THAAD missile system. Ah. This X-band radar is used to cue the Mark 41 Aegis Ashore systems in Poland and Romania, but it's now been repurposed by the United States to replace the eyeballs that we lost in Qatar. So now when the Iranian missiles are launched, this X-band radar is doing the initial cueing in an effort to make the system more effective. So the Iranians eventually are going to take this radar out, because this radar, once it takes away, that the whole system is blind. And if the Turks are in fact sharing data, then the Iranians will take out the Perinçalık site too, because Turkey is not an innocent party to this conflict. Turkey is an active participant in this conflict, because Turkey is providing targeting data for the ballistic missile defense architecture used by the United States and Israel to protect Israel and American military installations in the region.
Is it safe to say that Turkey is doing this, or by the fact that the United States happens to have a installation there, they're able to get that? I'm just trying to how culpable is Turkey? Because if Turkey says, look, the U.S. put this in there, we're a part of NATO, they're a part of NATO, you know, it's there, as opposed to Turkey is actually involved in the manifestation of the identification of these of this weaponry. Can you explain that?
There's two things. First of all, this is not a NATO conflict, so no NATO assets can be used in this conflict. Mm. Any asset that is being delegated to this war must be delinked from its NATO affiliation.
That's
just a straight-up legality.
Yeah.
And so if Turkey wants to hide behind the NATO wall, then they should be telling the United States that none of this data can be shared. But the point is, Turkey not only knows what the United States is doing, but is actively facilitating it, because Turkey is part of the communications link. They are they facilitate and enable the linkage. Turkey has a different motivation here, and this is again where the Turks are not being very honest. We can move east towards Azerbaijan and Armenia, mm-hmm. the Zanguzar corridor. Turkey has been a proponent of carving out this 46-mile-long corridor linking Nakhchivan, the Azerbaijani enclave that borders with Turkey, through Armenia, southern Armenia, to the main part of Azerbaijan. J.D. Vance was just in the region about a month ago, actively promoting this. Trump has named it after himself. But Iran has been a vociferous opponent of this. They said if you build this corridor, we will militarily intervene. And so Turkey and Azerbaijan, I believe, are exploiting the current situation in order to create a fait accompli, to generate conflict, instability in Iran so that the Zangezur corridor can be rapidly produced and then supported by the United States. There's a lot going on behind the scenes here. The Turks are not innocent parties to this conflict. They are active participants in this conflict, and they have broader geopolitical motives behind their actions. And Iran has every right to hold Turkey accountable for what it's doing.
Let me ask you this question. How much has Iran expanded and or improved its weaponry since the 12-day war? And as a caveat to that question, let me ask you how much of that has been attributable to their assistance from the Russians and the Chinese?
Well, first of all, we should never denigrate Iran's indigenous capabilities. They are a power in their own right. Mm-hmm. The missiles they have produced are not because North Korea provided them technology, Russia provided them technology. The missiles they produce are because Iran has developed this technology themselves. Iran has been engaged. This is True Promise 4. That means that there has been True Promise 1, 2, and 3 prior to that. True Promise 3 was the 12-day war. Iran collected a tremendous amount of intelligence during True Promise 2 and True Promise 3 that was used to upgrade their ballistic missile capabilities. And they are in the continuous process of collecting this data and making modifications to their warheads, to the targeting systems, et cetera. So the missiles that Iran has have benefited from continuous conflict over the past year and a half with Israel and indeed with American missile defense systems. These missiles are optimized to defeat the American missile defense systems. It's just a warning to those proponents of the Golden Dome out there. It will not work. It will never work. And Russia will always defeat it because nations that have sound ballistic missile technology will always overcome ballistic missile defense technology. This is a statement of truth that's being played out in real time over the skies of Israel as we speak. Now, in terms of cueing, targeting is that you can have a missile that's very accurate unless you put it at the right target, you don't know what you're doing. So getting cueing information is very important. The Iranians had a very effective intelligence relationship with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah was able to provide some very solid cueing information to the Iranians. Hezbollah's capabilities have been degraded somewhat, but they're still actively involved. But getting real-time cueing intelligence data from nations possessing overhead collection capability, satellites, is essential for,
Wow, look at that. We're looking at a missile now, and you can almost see the interceptors just, they go by it. In fact, the interceptors sometimes blow up themselves instead of the missile when we look at these videos. There it is. Goes right by it.
Well, some of the interceptors are designed to explode in front of a missile, but they're playing catch up. They're never able to catch up with the interceptor. The other thing is the interceptors are are programmed. You talked about moving in like an S-shaped system. That's because the interceptor launches and then has to make an adjustment to get an intercept angle. But by the time it completes that intercept angle, the Iranian missiles are accelerating on their own. These are missiles that don't maintain the same speed. They can accelerate because they have rocket, and they maneuver. So the missile's doing an S-shaped turn, seeking to hit a point where there's an intercept solution. And the Iranian missile's not anywhere near there because it has accelerated past or maneuvered to a different area. This is why they're missing. Our technologies cannot keep up with the advancements that the Iranians made. But we get back to targeting. The Iranians are showing an ability to get intelligence information inputs in the morning and strike in the afternoon with deadly effect. And also, they're starting to expand their target deck. Remember, they didn't invent the concept of regime change. That was Israel on day one, killing Ali Khamenei. Last night, the Iranians struck the home of Benjamin Netanyahu. They killed his brother. They struck the home of Ben-Gvir. He is seriously wounded, may not survive. Iran is going to start to take out the totality of Israel's leadership. This is the reality of this conflict. Israel played the regime change game. It's going to be the Israelis that are going to be paying the highest price. The Iranians are no longer wearing kid gloves. They've taken them off and they're coming in bare knuckle.
They're reporting it. This is interesting. I looked it up as soon as you said it. The BBC is reporting it as Ben-Gvir was in a car accident last night. Does that surprise you?
You know, they can report it any way they want. We know that his home is on fire. So maybe he crashed his car into his house.
That's interesting. I mean, the only reason I just can't help but be amused by this, because it would not surprise me for the BBC to provide cover for story like this.
Now know that the BBC reporters that work overseas are vetted by MI6 before they're allowed to take on their assignment. So the fact that they're colluding with Mossad to provide cover for, because what you don't want to do is confirm success. You from a battle damage assessment perspective, you don't want to confirm an Iranian success. And so what you'll do is you'll lie, you'll obfuscate, you'll cover. It's a standard operational technique. But the fact that the BBC, who's supposed to be a journalistic outlet telling the truth, is actively engaged with the Israelis to create cover for the effectiveness of an Iranian strike proves that the BBC is no longer a journalistic outlet. It is purely 100% involved in information operations that are being put together by the MI6, by the CIA, by Mossad.
I've been trying to nail down what the casualties are for the United States, and I've heard everything from 6 to 8 to 600, and I can't really draw a bead on this. Do you have a better take? And I know these things sometimes are foggy, but do you have a better take on just how many U.S. troops have actually, or U.S. personnel even, have been hit or affected in this war so far?
What I'm going to say is probably going to disappoint a lot of people who are hoping that the United States pays a heavy price. I, on the one hand, will never cheerlead for dead Americans.
Of course not.
As immoral and amoral as this administration is when it comes to the lives of Iranians and of people in the Middle East.
Of little
and
girls.
Of Israelis.
Of little girls.
170 little girls. We can get into that if you want to, because I got some information on that. But The fact is, when an American service member dies, there are legal requirements when it comes to reporting. Mm-hmm. There are a handful of cutouts. If you're in a classified assignment or with a classified unit, we can delay reporting over a period of time, and we can disguise the cause of death. But if you're just a standard frontline soldier, when you die, it has to be reported. It has to. It's by law. It's not allowed. So when you ask me how many Americans are dead, I would say 8 Americans have died, because I don't believe the United States is capable of covering up. How many are wounded? That could be a different thing. That's not necessarily an immediate reporting factor. But just to play, because my good friend George Galloway has repeated the story about 173 Delta Force operatives somehow.
I saw that, and I couldn't nail it down. I think it's fair.
I've worked with Delta Force. In peace and in war. Let me just get the biggest thing in the world. They will never be taken prisoner. These are the hardest badasses that ever walked the face of the earth, and they will fight to the death. Yeah. Moreover, if you surround 173 Delta Force operators, they're going to be still fighting their way out of that. These guys are very good at what they do. Doesn't mean they're immortal. Just look at Mogadishu, Black Hawk Down. Delta suffered a significant number of casualties, and they die in battle all the time. But the idea that 173 of Delta Force operators are going to surrender is just the absurdity. They will go down like the Alamo. They will never surrender, ever. It just isn't in their DNA.
Yeah, I saw that. I love George. George is a wonderful guy, and I saw his report this morning, so I immediately went in and started doing all the thing and making calls, and I got nothing on that. I was not able to even an inkling of a confirmation on that. Let's talk about the United States again. Give me a sense of what you think it's going to take for this administration to dig itself out of this hole that they're in right now. Knowing Mr. Trump has an incredible ability to turn everyone else's situation into his victory and his win, do you expect, as some would say, that he's just going to declare victory in the next couple of days and walk away from this thing? And what kind of stench would that leave, if any?
First of all, again, I mean, it's time to be brutally honest. I apologize if I'm about to insult anybody, but the American people are the most ignorant people in the world about the world they live in. They know nothing about the world, and therefore they're easily deceived. They're easily duped, and they are being duped and deceived by this administration about a potential threat from Iran. We have Americans who think it's okay to slaughter 170 schoolgirls because some Iranian expatriates and diaspora in Los Angeles object to other Iranian women wearing the hijab in Tehran, even though we know that the hijab rules have been loosened in Tehran.
Yeah, I was just there. Spent a week in Tehran. I saw most of the women there that reminded me of the women in Los Angeles. They were, in fact, some of them, I'll just say it, were scantily clad when they were going to nightclubs and fancy restaurants. So, and many of them did not wear any headwear. And a lot of them did. Sure. So,
The tragedy is that those days are over. By attacking Iran the way that they have, by assassinating the supreme leader, these Western inclinations will be stamped out. We now have a far more conservative supreme leader than the one we killed. And he's surrounded by ayatollahs now who view the West, rightfully so, as Satan, as the enemy, as the threat. And so the notion of yielding to, sentiment among a minority of Iranians to loosen the hijab rules, et cetera, I think we shoot our own selves in the foot. Had we let Iranian democracy, and Iran is a functioning democracy, the greatest functioning democracy in the Middle East, I'll just say that too. If anybody wants to challenge me on that fact, we can debate that till you're blue in the face and you will always lose. Iran is the greatest functioning democracy in the Middle East. And they listen to the people. But what happened is the CIA, Mossad, MI6, took advantage of that and created, these outlets for violence, political violence, that led to this conflict. And so Iran is going to cleanse house, and it may be another decade or so, if ever, if they can return to the status you saw when you were walking through the streets of Tehran. Mm-hmm. This is the stupidity of the diaspora. These fake Iranians are out there dancing, celebrating the death of Ali Khamenei, and ignoring the fact that the United States, on the opening day of the war, fired 4 cruise missiles into a facility that was evacuated by the Revolutionary Guard Command long before the conflict. One of these missiles struck a school. The fourth missile, 3 missiles, 2 missiles struck empty warehouses, 1 struck a school. The fourth missile was loitering over the site, collecting data, sending it back for battle damage assessment. The 2 warehouses were empty, no secondary explosions. But the third site that they struck, they noticed an accumulation of human beings, people running to the site. And so they ordered the fourth missile to strike. The fourth missile went up, came down, and hit. The missile is designed to penetrate with a bunker-busting capability, but there's an additional factor to this missile. Our brilliant weapons designers have concluded that the excess fuel in a Tomahawk missile at the moment of impact can actually be weaponized into a thermobaric weapon, a fuel-air explosive. Oh. And so they hit the button, turned the excess fuel into a thermobaric, and the people they saw running were the children who survived the initial attack. They went to the prayer hall with their teachers, and they asked the parents to come in and retrieve their children. Parents were on their way. So the movement you saw were survivors going into the building, teachers with them, parents come to them, and we put the fourth cruise missile in there, turned it into a thermobaric bomb, and burned these children alive. That's this war in a nutshell.
Yeah.
We don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're targeting. And all we're doing is murdering people. And you know why this happened? Because Pete Hegseth canceled a Department of Defense directive that required a civilian mitigation team to go over each target to make sure that we weren't striking the wrong targets. He called that woke. He called that ineffective. He wanted to be the most lethal fighting force in the world. Kill, kill, kill. Well, Pete, you killed him. 170 of them, children. You're a murderer. You're a war criminal. And so is Donald Trump. And so is every American who supports this war. Because this war is an illegal war of aggression. We aren't obeying the laws of war. And we're simply slaughtering innocent people to appease a bunch of neoconservatives who have an outdated concept of what the world should look like and who have completely subordinated the interests of the United States to the state of Israel. And I apologize for losing my temper.
No, I'm a
father of 2 girls, and I would hunt down and kill anybody who brought harm to my children.
Scott Ritter, obviously, from what you can see there, someone who is involved in this from a visceral standpoint because he's a Marine, because he's an American, and because he believes in the Constitution And he also happens to be, and for this I thank you, Scott, the explanation that you gave us about some of these things, few people would be able to explain it as well as you do. You really are so good at surmising this thing and helping us understand, those of us who don't have a military background, like myself, you've been able to make us understand how these things develop and why the things that we're seeing happen are happening. Thanks again, my friend. Always great to see you, Scott. Take care. God bless.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk now about Maria Zakharova. She was fit to be tied, even more so than Scott the other day, when she sat down for an interview with me. A Russian spokeswoman got extremely heated when I played a video of Mike Pompeo saying that Russians are indecent people and that they're not even normal. It's just like, here's what you said about what she said. So let's start with at Amias says, Zakharova did the Slavic stare. There is such a thing, by the way. She says she did the Slavic stare at the beginning that made me feel like she was looking into my soul through the screen, says that person. At Don Manchner says, it sure is nice listening to a government spokesperson that doesn't try to spend all day gaslighting us. It's quite refreshing. Kaizan 5901 says, why is there a question of Russia or China helping Iran? USA openly helps Zionist Israel to commit genocide. Ask them this question. Okay. Berkeley Butcher says, Mr. Sanchez, do you ever have black guests? I like your style of journalism since you were at Channel 7 in Miami. Wow. Of course we do. We never decide who we're going to interview based on their skin color. So if the person who is best to speak on that topic happens to be green or blue or white or black or whatever he happens to be or she happens to be, by golly, they're going to be on this show. At Sean Kennedy says, she, referring to Zakharova, is one of the most powerful orators, a great representative for her country. I'll tell her you said that or have my people talk to her. She's not mad. I loved when she said, in Russia, we don't care what Americans think. Rick Sanchez should know that America keeps electing a government that goes around the world committing atrocities in their name. And I think this is the last one. Boro B.R. Jovnovic, whatever. Sorry, I butchered that. Says, who says beauty and clever can't exist together? Thanks for the good analysis. Wait, one more. Longsi says, Ms. Zakharova always gets to the core of the matter. A nation governed by a pervert bunch of folks will always tell and act in a twisted manner. Whoa, that one snuck in there. All right. As usual, we appreciate all the feedback that you send with us. Check out my pages. You can find me now on BitChute. You can find me on Spotify. You can find me on YouTube. You can find me on X. Go to any one of those places. Pick your favorite, and you'll see me there, and you can leave a comment, and we will read it and maybe even share it with others here on TV. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for letting us into your homes, and we will be looking for you next time.